Claire will give a student presentation. Fred is not here. I want to talk after that about 3D data just for a little bit, and then I'll have a presentation on some issues involving population when you measure from different populations, which aren't specific to morphometrics, but I think are important. But anyway, we'll go for that. Yeah.
Thank you. I will present the project I have for this class. And it's about wings venation as a predictor of caste in three Vespa species. So we have these three species, Vespa velutina, Vespa tropica, and Vespa proboscis. Two of them are endemic in France, and one of them is an invasive species. And they are very different wing shape. You can see here, and this one is a lot smaller than the other two one, but the other two one are more or less the same size. And these are a social species. Their colony are composed of workers, males, and queens. And each case exhibits difference in morphology. So I was interested in wondering, are wings morphology a good indicator of caste, and if the change between caste is similar between different species? So to address this question, I have a data set of wings. We have 17 landmarks in the wings, in the venation of the wings, at the intersection of veins, and two at the maximum curvature of the wing. And I have around 80 specimens per species, with 40 genii, 40 queen, and 40 workers. And so my first analysis is a canonical variation analysis, and you can see that each species is very well separated in this space.
In these wasps, there are just the two. The only castes are queens and everybody else. Is that
there is queen workers, which are sterile females, and the males. But the males, it's like in honeybees, the males are produced only in the spring and die just after.
Okay.
So here you can see also the change in shape. Sorry, the picture is very small. So you have the change between Vespa crabro and Vespa velutina, and you can see there is not a lot of transformation between the two species that are endemic from France again. And here you have the difference between Vespa crabro and the tropica, and between tropica and velutina, and you can see there is much more difference between those species than between these two, and most difference seems to be in this part of the wings. So wing shape seems to be a good indicator of the species for these three species of wasp. And if we look at each species independently, so here you have the result for Vespa crabro and the difference between the two castes, the genii and the workers. You can see again that the difference seems to be here and here mostly, but they're very well separated in the space, and you can really use the shape of the wing to predict which caste there. And it's the same result for Vespa velutina, with somehow a less clear separation, but still good enough to be a predictor. And you have maybe a small change here, otherwise it's kind of similar of shape.
The change is so small and yet separates so clearly must mean that the within caste variation is very small.
It's very, very small, yeah. Should I?
I'm sorry, I interrupted
you. Should I put that on my analysis at the end? The within caste difference?
Well, I mean, I'm just saying the obvious, so maybe you don't have to.
Okay. And yeah, you have the same result for Vespa tropica. Again, more clear than the one just before, with, again, differences locating here mostly, and a clear separation. So the one that separates less obviously, definitely Vespa velutina. And so if I plot all the results together, here you have difference between caste for the three species. And again, you can see that the difference seems to be located more here. And again, velutina seems to have very few variation between caste. And so my future direction would maybe to find other analysis to compare wing shape across species and caste, because maybe this analysis is not the best to highlight difference. I also have access to the geographic data, because the species were caught in metropolitan France and in the downtown, in the, what do you say that? In La Réunion, in island far away from France, called the geographic France. And I would like also to find information about the phylogeny between species and their level of sociality, because maybe Velutina, which is the one that separates the less, may not have the same level of sociality than the other two one, like maybe less differentiation between queens and worker, and this kind of stuff. And thank you.
Thank you.
So, Claire, yeah. For your species, for your specimen sampling, are you taking from, are all your specimens from the same hive, or are they all from different hives?
Different hives.
So they should all be genetically fairly diverse, so that there's not going to be like a clone issue there.
So I think I have to investigate more, but I think one of them is more macro colony than the other one, like in the same area. There is different colony, but they talk to each other. They are not aggressive with each other, while other species are more separated. So I should investigate that. And for some of them, they don't know which colonies they are, yeah, because they were catching the wild. Like, especially for outside France, they don't really know.
The outside France, you mean the Caribbean? Or do you mean, oh, that's a long way away?
Yeah, the tropical one is both present in metropolitan France
and in the Caribbean. But the other two are not.
No, the other two are specific for France. But they are caught between two different mountain areas in France that are pretty far away from each other. So.
I wonder, I mean, it astonishes me that these tiny changes are so repeatable. I wonder, do you have a way of, could there be direct environmental effects on these characters? In addition to genetic differences, they are living in, you were making the point, they're living, are they living in the same areas or separated geographically?
So depending on which species. Tropica, because it's an invasive one, are just spread everywhere.
Everywhere, yeah.
Whereas the two of one are more separated.
They're separated from each other.
Yeah.
And then Tropica is present everywhere. Mm. Well, I guess you could look at Tropica and see whether it seems to be geographically differentiated. That doesn't tell you whether that's genetic or genetic differentiation or a direct environmental effect. And I don't know that I see an easy way of separating those unless you're not doing common garden experiments, you're not transplanting hives and thing, or taking bees from one hive and creating a new hive somewhere else, I guess. But the other point is the phylogenetic comparative method issue is maybe your data are not so strong on that because you only have three species. So any phylogeny you have is just a three species phylogeny. That means that the standard methods you're using get you 2 degrees of freedom out of that, and a 2 degree, well, it gets you two. Like if you're doing a regression, it gets you 2 points. And a 2-point regression will always be fit perfectly, but it also means you have no information to say anything about. Pretty far towards the small end of what you can do with phylogenetic, with between species methods.
The thing I was wondering if it's worth it to see maybe Velutina is more ancient.
You mean which one is the more is
the one that doesn't vary that much? Maybe is the one that is more.
Well, did you say one of these didn't vary much?
Yeah, one of those doesn't vary as much. This one is
this
one that varies.
You mean they don't vary between the casts?
Yeah.
Between
yeah.
casts, yeah.
And it's like if I do, so it's not very relevant for this class, but if I do a machine learning predict cast with this one, I would have some error.
of some error, but not very much.
Not very much, yeah. Whereas over to one, I have 0%
error. Yeah, I mean, it amazes me that two things that I cannot, you know, I can barely see the difference between them. I guess what it means is that if you were to measure, I'm wondering, to what extent are your data affected by collecting all of those points, or to what extent can you just go, you know, in an area, just like when I look at this, I see a little bit of difference here and a little bit of difference there. Could one say throw away all those points and still get the same result? I don't know. I mean, one of the questions would be, does collecting all of those points help? I suppose it's easy enough to investigate. You just drop things from the data and see if that changes. But it surprises me. It means, for example, if somebody were trying to diagnose differences using this, they would have to be very careful in collecting their data because of a little bit of error in collecting it. But I suppose these things have color pattern differences as well. So.
Between species.
Yeah, you don't really have a problem telling them apart anyway. But this is it's very interesting. One other last point. When you're looking at pairwise discrimination, mm-hmm. in these, are you using the overall canonical variance, or are you doing a separate analysis for just the two groups?
Separate analysis.
So it's a discriminant function analysis. And since it's always possible that the within variation is a bit different in each of the three groups, I would expect a two-species discrimination to be more accurate than one using the canonical variance.
Yeah. You mean if I do that using those variations?
Yeah, if you were to use those variants, which is pooling the within-species variation, for example.
It's less.
And it also means that the canonical variants 1 and 2 are partly being chosen because of their ability to separate the left-hand one from the others. Whereas when you're just trying to separate the red from the blue, maybe the axes become a little bit different. Yeah. I mean, I think that...
It's less...
Okay, so you're aware of those issues, and because you know the model for canonical variance is just that within species variation is sort of assumed to be the same, and then the axes are chosen to maximize the variance, not for any particular discrimination among pairs. So
should I do another analysis to compare?
Well, I just thought it would be interesting to look at your discriminant analysis between each pair. We'll come up with somewhat different axes, I think. And it'll be interesting. Now, maybe those diagrams show you that. The problem we have is we can't see them very well. But
yeah, do you want me to present?
Well, where are the differences show? I see. Those are very small blue arrows. Is that what those are? Oh,
yeah.
So they are hard to look at.
Yeah, and basically,
it's not easy
not
from
that much,
yeah from this projection. It's not so easy to see whether the directions are similar or different.
Do you want me to put them bigger? I can do that.
Yeah, it would actually help at least if you happen to be able to do that easily. I didn't mean to make you ruin your pictures here.
Do you see better like this?
Yeah, I think, yes. I think we could. But.
I think there is something interesting here.
Yeah, up at the top, the...
But definitely this is not very informative.
Yeah, where are the biggest differences on the right? I'm not in there. Which are so they are somewhat different axes.
Yeah, they don't move similarly between species. maybe more between those two, which is where the...
Well, if they move similarly, then they'd all be lined up in a line, which they're not. So.
Okay. I guess what I wanted to say is you can see gas difference here, here for those two species, but nothing
not there. Yeah. Oh, interesting. Okay, so more questions? Are we
So you said that like within the species, the differences between the castes were kind of similar in this in those five-ish points.
Yeah.
Is there any like possibly? What do you think is going on with that? Is it like a selective constraint on wing shape where the workers who I presume are more active need some certain...
So, yeah,
is there some way you've got something going on there if you think about that?
So, yeah, I definitely... Very interesting question. I definitely should think about that. I'm not... It's very surprising me that it's ear. Like, I would have expected ear or ear for workers that go out and have to forage a lot and the queen doesn't have that much to forage. And yeah, I don't really know what's going on here, but I should.
That's cool.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah. Pretty something cool. Happening, but I don't find a way to relay, to have a biomechanic understanding of that.
Can I ask a question? How many differences do you think? What's the role of your
like,
so
the
lines in the
wings? Yeah.
So what
do you
have for?
It's a Venetian. It's basically where the hemolymph goes in the wing. And those are the spots where the wing is more, it's kind of easy what I would say, it's more robust.
So like, that affect how they fly for the wing.
And it will affect how much they can take a shock in the wing. Because you know, the wing can fold itself,
sure,
bend a little. And the Venetian point are usually where the wing doesn't, the point of bending.
They are not the point of
bending. They are the point of bending.
They are.
They are.
They can be a point of bending that is very resistant.
Okay, yeah.
But I mean, it's not. It doesn't have to bend always. You know, it's really depending on what they, on what they bend in.
This is getting off on a tangent, but so are the Venetians like, tubes, in, are they cylindrical inside of the, and then hydrodynamically like filled?
So that filled? I'm not sure that complete cylindrical.
But they're like, but they have some sort of filled. Oh, and that's what lies in the flex of them. Okay.
Well, presumably, I mean, is that like when the wings are inflating, is material pumped out through those tubes?
Yeah,
is
it's just blood of insect.
I mean, during development, but do they solidify later, or?
They solidify just after birth. It's very,
after
very
they get the wings out,
yeah,
then they become solid, and
yeah,
they don't.
Yeah, when they're
yeah
born, it's all fold. But yeah, I don't really know if it's cylinder or not.
Place your connection here by mine. Thank you. Okay, maybe before I get this up, I want to say a few words about things three-dimensional, which I don't know very much about. Just a second here. Well, we'll get to this in a moment. Let me say a few words about three-dimensional structures. And I really think Fred should have been the one to talk about this. He says there is material in the Chapter 5 material that he gave you on 3D structures. But I just wanted to give you my impression. When I started working with Fred on our endlessly delayed my morphometrics and phylogeny paper, I knew we needed a biological example, and I sort of assumed it would be a 3D some 3D skull data from mammals. It turns out it is skull data from mammals. The data set that Fred got is one that he's used in this course, which involves skull landmarks, but in the mid plane of the skull. So they're not 3D forms. They're just a 2D form. Now, of course, a 2D form is easier to use as a classroom example because you're projecting on a 2D plane. But I was surprised to find when I started talking to Fred about 3D. That although the analysis looks the same, there's an additional complication, and the complication makes it hard to come up with good examples. You can take landmarks in 3D. That's becoming easier than it used to be. It used to be, of course, that getting 3D landmarks was hard. You had to take a skull and use pointers and measure how far you push the pointer in various directions, and it was slow. It's getting faster, but that's not the only problem. When you do 3D information, for example, on something like a skull, you have the issue that humans, at least, and many mammals are bilaterally symmetrical. So you might think, well, okay, there'll be some way of dealing with that. We have to find the midplane, and then it will prove to be that the landmarks on either side will be in symmetrical locations. If that were really true, all you'd have to do is find the midplane and collect one of those sets, one side, and forget about the other because it's going to be symmetrical. Well, apparently, when I talked to Fred about what's the optimal way of doing that, he said, he kept bringing up difficulties, and he kept saying, the difficulty is that humans, for example, aren't completely symmetrical, that your landmarks on the two sides won't be in exactly the same location. And that's true of the other mammals, too, and it's true of many other 3D forms. So you'll end up having a midplane that you could infer, and it won't be precisely placed because if you're using the landmarks to define it, and the landmarks on the different sides are wandering from their completely symmetrical position. And basically, what happens is that gets you into a whole analysis of departures from symmetry. And I don't know much about the methods for this. Fred has been involved in developing a lot of those methods. But the message I got from him was basically, we'll be better off using 2D landmarks for our example in the paper, because then we don't have to deal with all these symmetry issues and somehow resolve them in order to get an example. And I was rather surprised because it seemed to me that 2D landmarks were out of date and that everything should be done 3D. I should mention that the math involved in doing 3D is basically the same as 2D. The difference is that when you're doing a Procrustes like superposition of forms, you of course have location. In 2D you would have two dimensions of location to play around with. In 3D you just get a third dimension. There's nothing, and once again you superpose the centroids. The rotation around the centroids, the resizing is the same, you just do it uniformly in all directions. And the rotations, instead of rotating in two dimensions, you're rotating in three, so there's an extra angle of rotation. But the math of that is straightforward, and how to do Procrustes is straightforward. So in a sense, there are no complications going from 2D to 3D. It's not major complication, but the thing that comes in and makes it difficult is this whole issue of symmetry. So it's a complication. You should be aware of the complication. You should realize why so many of the examples in this course are 2D. Now, some of you here have 2D data. I mean, your data is eminently 2D. Somebody else had wing venation. Didn't one of you also do wing venation? Or no, I guess Fred used it as an example. I'm just trying to remember how many of you have data that's inherently 2D. I'm just curious. Yours isn't, well, yeah, and yours. The others are 3D data, but you're looking like a mid-plane landmarks. Is that, would that fair to say? Yeah, I guess that's right. In the bird beaks, you're taking the mid-plane.
It's not even the mid-plane. Because the beak has two edges that are coming together, and basically looking from the side and measuring along one edge.
Well, in looking from the side, you're in effect placing a mid-plane and going perpendicular to it.
That would be,
you know, I think. So that's... and your bat skulls, you again are taking just measurements along some sort of middle place or plane. It's probably a plane, but... I mean, I guess... Okay, but again, like Cooper's, you have a lateral view, and the lateral view means there's something perpendicular to that, so that's the assumed midpoint. So, yeah. So... I just wanted to mention it because we haven't talked about 3D. Fred says there is material in Chapter 5 and said, well, they must have all read it. Which may be asking a lot, but so I just wanted to just comment on that. And what I want to spend the rest of the time doing is talking about an issue that isn't special to morphometrics, like many of the things that I've talked to you about. It's a general problem for analyzing continuous character data, and it's to agonize a bit about point out a problem with looking at different populations of the same species. Because we talked about all these levels, we had growth following the same individual or population of individuals through time and growth data. We had within species variation, and we had between population variation, and that's what I will talk about. And then, of course, we talked about phylogenies a fair amount. And the issue here looks at first like it'd be very simple, and then turns out not to be. Let's see, the evolutionary forces, if you've gone out and collected data from a number of populations of a species, and you're thinking about the evolution of those populations, a simple catalog of evolutionary forces, it's not, you know, you can make up others, one is you could imagine that in each population there could be natural selection on your traits towards an optimum, a multivariate optimum. So ordinary optimum selection, you might imagine, is working in each of the populations. There is genetic drift in the populations that's making them more different from each other. And there is migration, which is making adjacent populations more similar. Now, I've left out mutation. You can think of mutation as pumping up the genetic variability in each population. One assumes that the mutational processes are very similar in the different populations. At least there's no reason to do that. But as far as creating differences between populations, these are the major forces that you can think of. So you can think of there being natural selection possibly acting to make the populations more different by having different optima in different populations. And one of the issues that I want to address here is the issue of whether what we do if we're trying to look at these data and correlate the phenotypes in different populations with some environmental variable or variables. So we might have different populations, and let's say we have different mean annual temperatures for the populations, and we want to get an idea whether we can see any relationship between the phenotypes in those populations and the mean annual temperature of the populations. Now, when you have that, let's see, you might think that it's easy, because you might think, well, we just treat each population as a data point. We measure the environmental variable. We measure the mean phenotype in the population. And we do a regression. And here, I have imagined, this is all based on a simulation. As usual, I recharge these batteries and then they don't work. I think what happens is this thing, when it's sitting in my pouch, the button gets pushed and the battery drains. Suppose we had 100 populations in a straight line, which is very idealized. We're just collecting populations along a coastline. And suppose the optimum of a phenotype changed linearly along that coastline, perhaps as a result of differences in temperature or something, some environmental variable. And suppose that in each population, the optimum was therefore a little bit different. The phenotypes will vary around the optimum due to two things. One would be genetic drift, but the other, of course, which I haven't really talked about, is sampling variation. You probably didn't sample an infinite number of individuals from each population. You might have sampled 10 individuals from each population. So some of this variation is real. And some of the variation is your sampling variation, and that's okay. Now, in this case, the computer simulation I did involved separate optimum selection in each population to an optimum that was changing linearly. Now, if we take this and say we want to know whether there is if we measure, let's say, a linear change of temperature, which I haven't put on here, we want to see if there's a regression there. We want to see if populations with higher temperatures have a higher value of the phenotype. So the naive thing to do is just do a regression to say, okay, we regress everything on temperature. Let's imagine that we somehow know that the temperature is linearly changing linearly. And so we could fit a straight line. Well, actually, this isn't the fitted line. This is the true differences of optimum. But you could look at that and say, just do a regression. Now, in this computer simulation, I didn't have any migration among populations. I just left each population to individually wander around its optimum. So if I look at the deviation of a population from a regression line might be a little bit different from this true optimum line, are the deviations independent? Are the errors at each point independent? Let me ask you to come up with an answer for that in this case, in this simulation.
Well, even without migration, there is still some sort of underlying phylogeny, right? The populations are still, some of them are still more.
Well, I mean, we imagine this is one species, so it's a one lineage, within which there has been some geographic differentiation, presumably through the whole evolutionary process. I mean, it's possible that the geographic layout that we see now is not the same as it was even fairly recently, in which case you could worry about historical effects.
I'm just thinking something like serial colonization would also induce.
Yeah, you could have that. I mean, you could have everything started here and it went serially, and then, say, some genetic drift events that occurred during that affect everything to the right because they colonize from left to right, let's say. So, yeah, you could. If you were just to leave this simulation and have things wander up and down in each population, naively does it look independent?
Naively, yes.
Naively, yes, sir. These are, in the simulation I did, they are independent. And the regression would, in fact, be a proper analysis. Although, you would have to put in the following qualification. If these are arranged linearly, any other environmental variable that changes smoothly along here would be, to some extent, confounded with the temperature. If the temperature changed smoothly and the humidity, the average annual humidity, changed smoothly, then actually your ability to tell which it is might be compromised. So you do have to at least be aware of that. Okay, well, that's fine, but what about what happens if I put a little bit of migration in? So here we have adjacent populations are exchanging genes. I used what's called in population genetics a stepping stone model. And the stepping stone model, a panel in on that. It's just an idealized model of geography in which each population receives migrants from both sides, from the nearest population. So the individuals who are present in the population at each generation, a fraction m of them come from the two, symmetrically from the two neighbors, and 1 minus m of them come from that population. So what I did is to simulate this pattern of migration with the same migration rates all along the process. The two end populations received simply m over 2 coming from one side, and 1 minus that coming from home, and nobody from the other side. Okay, so I simulated that. I had genetic drift simulated by as a sort of normal perturbation. The assuming that the genes involved are kind of additive, not worrying too much about dominance or epistasis or anything like that, I basically said that the mean, what happens to the mean of the population under migration, is that it too becomes an average with these weights. So basically the mean in any stone, in the stepping stones, was 1 minus m times the mean of what was there, plus m over 2 times the means of the two neighbors. So it's a simple averaging using those weights. And then the optimum selection had this line as the position of the optimum. And there was a value in each of 100 stones here. And you assume a uniform optimum selection with a Gaussian-shaped fitness surface, which is arbitrary but convenient. And what it does as I indicated before, is that in each generation, it pulls you a fraction of the distance back towards the optimum. It's an Ornstein-Uhlenbeck-like random walk that's going on. So now everything is the same as in the previous graph, except that migration is moving genes among adjacent populations. And one thing you can immediately see, if I flip back to the other one, one thing you can immediately see, whoops, is that the variation is less. Can anybody give me a rationale for that? Why are the phenotypes varying less from their optimum? Yeah, the gene flow is what's doing it. And the gene flow is doing it by basically genetic drift in one population is getting averaged against the genetic drift in the neighbors, and therefore, as an average, it's varying less. So the gene flow means that you're moving towards a situation in which, you know, in the limit, if the genes were completely randomized every generation, it would be like saying that there's one big population, and being a bigger population has less genetic drift. So the more migration there is, the less effect genetic drift will have, and we're seeing that. That's not surprising, and it's not necessarily itself a problem. But another issue is, look at the deviations from, in this case, the optimum, but it would also be true for a regression line, are the deviations in different populations independent? And why not? You shook your head first.
Well, I mean, just sort of eyeballing it, we see in most places where you have a population above or below, you have the three or four closest to it also above or below.
And does that seem reasonable?
Especially not compared to the last one.
You mean you don't think it should be that way?
It should be that way given migration. It wouldn't be that way without something
going
okay, together.
So why does migration cause that to happen? I think it's straightforward, and I think you will.
Because if one of the populations has a higher value, it's sending off its migrants that also have that higher value, increasing the value of the weighted average.
Right. So genetic drift fluctuations in one population are exported to the other populations to some extent. And likewise, their genetic drift fluctuations get exported to you. So if you have two neighboring populations, when one is above the line just as a result of genetic drift, the other is likely to also be above the line. So the deviations are now not independent. Now, I should point out that the parameters I used for this, n is the population size in each population, m is the migration, the fraction of migration from the neighbors, and this f thing is the net result of selection. It's going 0.2% towards the optimum in each population, each generation. So those are the three parameters of age. So now, if I do a regression through these, and I fit using the standard regression, am I okay, or is there a problem? Now, the assumption of a standard regression is that points will deviate up and down from the line, and in the complete usual model, we assume a Gaussian curve, which is pretty much true here under this model. But it also assumes that the deviation of each point from the line is independent, identically distributed. That's built into the regression formulation. So when you fit the line, actually the fact that neighboring residuals are correlated actually is not so much a problem in terms of what line you end up with. You pretty much get the same line, whether or not you take that into account. But the minute you go and try to put confidence intervals on the slope, the amount of noise you have is very different from the amount of noise you would have if they were independent, because neighboring points are not independent assessments. They are, to some extent, fluctuating together.
So is the yeah. slope describing the rate of variation by distance?
I'm not sure what you're saying.
I think I'm confused by the population numbers, right? They're not.
These are just we went along the beach collecting every, 100 feet, and there are 10,000. We the total of 10,000 feet. We went 5 miles or so, 2 miles or so, so we got 100 different populations. So the number there is just a proxy for geography. And I'm assuming we're being idealized here, so we're assuming everything's equidistant and equal population sizes and everything. There are all sorts of ways this could go wrong. So now we have a regression that we're doing. The regression assumes independent residuals, but in fact the residuals are not independent. Does that cause trouble? Yeah. Sorry.
Does that inflate or deflate the inferred confidence intervals?
It makes the uncertainty in the slope greater than you think. So that is the confidence interval you get is too narrow, and I'll show you that in a simulation in a moment. I want to first just talk about the fact that before we get back to how to fix the problem, which turns out to be conceptually easy and in practice not so easy, we could be dealing with all kinds of other geographies. Here I made up a geography of a region that you've sampled in a grid. You're imagining populations at the points of the grid. Of course, real distributions of organisms are much messier than that. And we're imagining a gene flow according to a two-dimensional stepping stone model, but maybe here's a lake and here's the corner of another lake. There are no, it's a terrestrial organism, and there's nobody in the lake. So the geography looks something like that. And it's not a straight line. It gets complicated. In this case, it's two-dimensional. And basically, by the way, real-world geography is mostly two-dimensional. You might say, but we live in a three-dimensional world, but there are very few organisms you can think of that are actually distributed three-dimensionally, I claim. Okay, now suppose that I had genetic drift. Let's see if I can do this. With no differences in optima among those sites, but I believe this is done with some difference, with some migration. So this again is these are the covarying residuals. So what you will find is, depending on the population sizes and the migration rates and the exact geography, you'll find patches of individuals who have, let's say this is a medium low phenotype, this is a low, the dark blue is low phenotype, high phenotype is red. You'll have areas where things are lower and areas where things are higher, and the residuals will be correlated as a result of migration. So this is just a pictorial example. More generally, when you look at models of structured populations, this is a thing called a migration matrix. It basically just says between every pair of populations we can imagine that there might be gene flow. Some of those gene flows will be zero. In this scheme here, there is zero gene flow, direct gene flow between 5 and 3. Anybody who gets from 5 to 3 goes through 6 or goes through 1 and 2. And you could imagine having arbitrary migration rates on all of those arrows. fact, some of the arrows that are missing here, that's just the same as saying there are two arrows with rate zero. So you could think of populations in terms of simple stepping stone schemes, but you can also be more general and say, well, there's an arbitrary pattern of migration we want to know something about. Now, the other thing you have to take into account, which is a hard one to make yourself take into account, is that we might have collected seven populations here, but there may really be more populations. Maybe there's some unsampled populations. That's very common. It would be very common for that to happen. And therefore, what might really be going on is genetic drift, for example, and maybe some kind of optimum selection in a larger number of populations that include these, and the migration pattern that's relevant is not just between the populations you sampled, but is between the actual populations that are there. So there might be an intermediate population between 3, 4, and 7 here, and what looks like direct gene flow between them is, in fact, some of it is going through this unsampled ghost population. Nothing more mysterious is going on there than that we just didn't collect data from all populations. Okay. So you can imagine, you can think in the abstract, even when making abstract models, you can think of stepping stones, but you can also think of more general migration models. Here is, let's see, a scheme I made up for simulation. And I said, let me see if I, yeah. What I was imagining was not a single stepping stone chain, but a branch chain with an environmental variable, let's say average temperature, that's rising as you go up here and then rising up each of those branches, but with some similarity. I'm going to just show one more figure here and then go off to simulation and then come back. If you were in that case, here I did a simulation with genetic drift, migration, and optimum selection, in which I assumed that the optimum is a linear function of this environmental variable. So we're imagining that up in the populations that have 100 up there, that the optima are pretty much the same. And in the populations that, in each population, you're being pulled towards a value which is a linear function of that. Okay. Now, when I made a computer simulation of it, and I plotted individuals, I plotted population means. And by the way, these are the actual population means, not the mean of the sample, which would be a little bit noisier. Then you get what looks like a nice regression there, a fairly nice regression. Some of it involves that Y-shaped thing. I think you can kind of see that there is some sort of splitting. Looks like that might be the result of these two lineages drifting differently. Now, there is a way to analyze these data. One naively wants to just put a regression through it. And what I'm saying is watch out, worry, because of correlation of adjacent populations of their residuals owing to gene flow. Okay. Now, let me show you how that becomes a problem. I'm going to show you a simulation using R. Let's see. And I'm going to come back and talk about a way of escaping the problem. Let me get to an R environment here, where I'm in the wrong place. Okay, so now let me see if I think what I have to do is get a program from my I didn't download the correct program. Bring down the R. Okay. So if I go into R, no. Damn it. Hold on a second. I'm trying to. Sorry, I have to go find the particular program on my computer. Sorry, I'm being silly here. I am, oh gee, that's terrible. I am trying to, what I've just done is lose one of the two R functions that I wrote this morning. I managed to, I think I may have managed to overwrite it. Well, when you're working in a hurry, things go wrong. But wait, there is a routine called programs here. There is hope. Nope, there is no hope. Okay, so I'm going to have to show you just... very, very annoying... There is hope. I have something stored in a copy buffer. This is utterly ridiculous. Why is that? No. Okay, all right, I'm going to have to just say this, tell you what the result is. I had a whole simulation figured out. I want to reassure you it was a lovely simulation. Unfortunately, I wrote the function, did not save it properly, and have copied something over it or something. Something is going badly wrong, so I'm just going to be describing. If you take a case like this, and I was using basically this case in the simulation, and you make you get a slope from a regression analysis, and you put a confidence interval on it, the confidence interval will be too narrow. It will be too narrow because the regression analysis assumes that the residuals are independent. If you were to take a case where the reality was that there was no difference in the optimum, that the point where there really was no difference from one population to another, and you look at the data and you seem to see a slope, you can put a confidence interval on that slope, but it will be too narrow. And because it is too narrow, what you will have happen is that the sorry. I'm sorry about the confusion here, but it suddenly occurred to me. Nope. I thought maybe I had it somewhere else. I don't. I'm going to go back to this. Okay. If there's no slope, then what you'd expect is if you put a confidence interval on the slope, it should include zero. At least it should include, if it's a, let's say you're using a 95% confidence interval, then 95% of the time, the confidence interval should include zero. And what I was going to show you here and develop this beautiful R function, which I have now managed to somehow lose, what I was going to show you was that if you have zero slope here instead of the slope I'm showing you, and you put confidence intervals on the slope, not on the phenotype, but on the slope, that fewer than 95% of them include zero. And what you can show is that when you have migration rate of zero, I was doing like 100 replicates of, I would do this evolution 100 independent times, each time with a true slope of zero, and then I would show you that the coverage of those confidence intervals was much less than 95%. That if there was migration, it was much less. If there was no migration, then you will get the right answer on average. You'll get about 5% of your confidence intervals, not including the true value, which is zero, which is in that case zero. It's a null case. But you put a little migration in, and you get these correlation of residuals, and that corresponds to the regression making the wrong analysis and giving you a signal for slope being non-zero. In one case, I ran about 30% of the 100 replicates showed you a signal for non-zero slope because the residuals were correlated. So in effect, what it means is that instead of you think you have 100 points for the regression, but you've got fewer because of the sharing of noise between adjacent points. So is there a way out of this? I just wanted to indicate to you that in theory there is, in practice it's not really been put into analysis. I have a paper pointing out that you can get away from this. It's like the phylogeny case where contrasts based on the structure of the tree turn out to give us variables that are independent. It turns out you can do the same thing if you know the geographic structure. Now you may say, well, we can get a rough idea of the geographic structure just from geography. We could make some wild assumptions that maybe migration rate, that population sizes are about the same and migration rates are about the same. But these days there are better ways. In that collection of molecular data with large numbers of markers, particularly like large numbers of SNPs, for example, enables you to estimate the migration matrix among the populations. Now, that still leaves the ghost population issue unresolved. But if you have all the relevant populations, you can estimate contemporary, reasonable migration rates for them using coalescent methods and things like Markov chain Monte Carlo methods, using coalescent models and using multiple molecular markers. So you could imagine a case where you have multiple populations, you have some pattern of migration among them, and you can make an estimate of the migration matrix. Now it's only an estimate and it's noisy and you have to worry about that. But if you knew the migration matrix, it turns out that you can take eigenvectors and eigenvalues of the migration matrix, and take a spectral decomposition of the migration matrix, which is to say eigenvectors and eigenvalues, and from those you can make up contrasts And those contrasts have a very interesting property that properly scaled, they will deviate, they will get rid of the correlations due to migration. And the thing I'd like to show you here, well, first of all, if you do that contrast analysis using the Y-shaped structure in that Y-shaped example, it turns out to look like this. The plotting of, if you plot phenotype, if you plot the contrast of phenotype against the contrast of the environmental variable, you get a plot in which the residuals are not supposed to be dependent. They're supposed to be independent. So you can make a legitimate regression of these things, in theory. Yeah, please ask me a question. I'm dying up here.
Is there any particular reason that we would want to do it sequentially instead of, for example, trying to throw it into some large MCMC Bayesian method where you just sort of jointly average across the rate matrix and these phenotype environment selection at the same time?
Well, I think that what we're doing here, it would be equivalent to whatever you're doing if you've got that set up properly.
So this would be easier, probably.
And you'd have to have, you would have to have an MCMC machinery where you told it about the migration matrix, and you told it about the data, and you had the whole model, basically, you had, for example, some sort of multivariate normal model that had all the right correlations in it, and then you estimated the slope of the optimum. And then, yes, you would get out a Bayesian inference of the slope of the optimum, and if you'd set up everything up, it would be correct. But this is, you know, in this idealized cases, this is equivalent, and it's going to give you the same results. Let me show you, give you an idea what some of these contrasts would look like. Here's a simple-minded case that I developed for a paper some years ago in which we have five populations. We have migration along these edges here, and everybody migrates to this with the center. If you work out what the contrasts are for this, I've got them color-coded here. And the contrasts are basically one of them. Let's see, here we have to look at the color coding. Red, these are sort of traffic light colors with the purple also. So red and orange are high. No, look, are negative numbers, and purple and green are positive numbers. So what does that mean? And yellow is in the middle. It means that this contrast here, here's the first contrast. It's between the left populations and the right populations, with the center population kind of in between. So it's basically a leftness and rightness contrast. Over here, we have, let me see. This is a topness versus bottomness here. Over here, it is, this is a little trickier. It's a upper left versus upper left, lower right versus lower left, upper right. It's this versus that. Okay. And this contrast is everybody versus the middle. So actually, you know, the positive weight is here and the negative weight's out there, but in these contrasts you can flip all the signs around and it doesn't matter. So what it says is that although there is migration correlating these adjacent populations, these individual contrasts basically drift independently, which is, I think, is not immediately obvious. So using them, here's an example. Here's an example of a linear array of populations, a linear stepping stone, with a certain migration rate, 0.01, and a certain strength of selection. This is a strength of this is genetic drift. It's a combination of the population size and the migration rate. It's basically a parameter like n times n, which the amount of net amount of drift is really a function of that. But here there's actually no selection at all. And you look at the populations, and if you look at them, you look at them in order, it looks as if there is a nice regression. And it's quite possible that a regression analysis of that will find a significant slope. And the regression analysis will be wrong to do that, because what's going on here is these populations on the left are all rather correlated with each other, and so are these populations on the right, and they're drifting. These happen to have drifted up, and those happen to have drifted down. And because of the correlation, it looks like each independent point is validating that pattern, but those points aren't independent. So what happens if we take this and we take the contrast you get out of the migration rate? I should say, for those who are fans of mathematical biology, the contrast in a simple stepping stone is basically a Fourier analysis. It's basically the Fourier transform of these guys. When you do that, here are the contrasts from that same data plotted against, there just are different independent ones, and what you basically find is they're all independent of each other and they all vary about the same amount. And if you were to do the corresponding contrasts on the linear position of things, you basically would find that the regression was not significant. I didn't go all the way to doing that here. You can think about, in linear arrays of populations, the contrast, as I say, have to do with the Fourier transforms. What I'm doing here is, I'll just skip through this very quickly. Imagining a case where there's a large number of populations lined up here, each migrating to the next one, and they're all drifting. And there's a optimum selection, which has a rather weird pattern. It goes up and down and up and down and up and down in the sine wave. In fact, it's a mixture of sine waves. Well, what it turns out is the population, the mean phenotypes will follow this curve, because the migration, it basically shows that it's responding to the large scale changes of optimum much more than to small scale changes of optimum. And the reason for that is that the migration is damping these small ones much, much more than it's damping the big ones. And you can express all that quantitatively. You can show the extent to which that would be true. And you can see little responses, you know, little wiggles with respect to responding to this. But basically, the stable position of the optimum, if you were to run this, say without, if there were no genetic drift, it would come into line in that curve, where you're responding to sort of big changes in the environment more than small changes because of the way the averaging of migration works out. You can take Fourier transforms of this and make things more independent. Okay, direct effects of the environment, I already indicated when we were talking about Claire's presentation, that you have to worry about the possibility that what you're seeing are not genetic differences, but possibly direct effects of the environment. The way to get around that would be by doing a common garden experiment, which is not always available in many organisms. And there would be statistical ways of analyzing data, even without a common garden experiment, that would, by looking for a signal of local populations that have the same two environments, but because they are not near each other due to in the migration pattern, their residuals are not correlated. There is a way of getting at that. Nobody has done it. Okay, I'll just mention some previous work that's been done on this. The mathematics of stepping stone models and population genetics is work by Malico and Kimura and Weiss, with subsequent work by Takeo Maruyama. But there's the first paper to really address this issue of correlated residuals due to migration is by Tom Hansen, Scott Armbruster, and Antonsen in American Naturalist in 2000. They considered linear patterns, and they considered using Fourier transforms to uncorrelate the residuals, basically. Now, there's a subsequent paper by me. Much of the algebra that I didn't show you is in this paper. Unfortunately, it's a symposium volume. The actual way to get a hold of this is to go, if you go to my webpage, there's a link to papers, and it will get you ultimately to a place where you can get a PDF of the draft of the final pre-publication manuscript of this. Unfortunately, it's also not available in distributed software yet, which is a problem. And this shows you for a general migration rate, it's not just for the linear chain of populations, how you set up contrasts and how you would, in principle, do this. That's in principle. Nobody's giving you a package to do it with yet. I have to take it. It's been 14 years, but I have to basically get some kind of software out there that can do this, especially since the inferring migration matrices from genetic data continues to become more and more possible. So this is all by way of telling you that there's a problem and there's a theoretical solution, but not actually giving you any practical way to do it. But at least realize that if you do the simple regression, you're in trouble. And you're quite likely to get the wrong answers. And I was going to show you a really beautiful little simulation in which we had the true value of the regression was zero, and we came up with 100 different confidence intervals, and you got to see that many of them were not covering the true value when there was migration. And unfortunately, I hope I managed to find a copy of that program floating around somewhere, because I think I managed to write it and then lose it. So maybe write it again, but I didn't show you that. Now, we're going on to one last session. I'm not entirely sure what I'm going to talk about. If any of you have thoughts of things you would like to hear about, please let me know, because I'm kind of, I'm not so much running out of material, but the material I might talk about becomes less and less relevant, less and less immediately connected to morphometrics, and Fred won't be around, so the last lecture. I was thinking of telling you a little bit more about, in contrast method, there are some issues of sample size and how you deal with sample size. It's kind of an abstruse topic for this course. But if any of you can think of things that we haven't covered that you really would like to hear about, I can try to address them. So anyway, I'll stop there.